welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Walt Bowman, and he will be doing a series called Trinity and the Table, Mark 16. Today's session is called Jesus' Resurrection and the Meaning of God. So let's listen in on Walt.
When I did announcements at 7:30, I couldn't be there because I was down here at 8. At 8:10 or so, when they're done, I read a couple of children's letters to God. Here's my favorite. Dear Mr. God, how do you feel about people who don't believe in you? Somebody else wants to know. Smart, smart kid. Harriet Ann writes this, Dear God, are you real? Some people don't not believe it. If you are, you better do something quick. Ron wrote, Dear God, when you wrote the Bible, you made up all the words and spelled them any way you like. That is great. Most of the time I do it like that, but I am not doing so good. Aren't these wonderful? Dear God, I saw St. Patrick Church last week when we went to New York. You live in a nice house. Okay. Well, I'm going to try to do two related but distinguishable things in the Bible studies this week. We are going to each day do some biblical work. Today it's going to be with Mark 16, verses 1 to 8, the earliest written narrative that we have of the resurrection. And we'll be doing some work with the Bible each day. But I'm also going to combine that with Christian theory. Now, I hate to use that word because in America, most of us have a kind of disdain for theory as opposed to practice, especially ivory tower theorists who sit around in seminaries and colleges and spin ideas that don't seem to have anything to do with real life and reality. But I want to make a case for theoretical reflection, because theory is about how something works. Before you can drive a car, somebody had to do some theoretical thinking about automotive engineering. And if they hadn't done that thinking, there wouldn't be machines that we can get into and turn a key and drive off. So while it takes people to build automobiles today, behind them lie theorists. And if you have bad theory, you're going to get a bad car. If you have good theory, hopefully, you will get a car that works. So part of what is necessary for Christianity is also that it have theorists, that is, people who try to ask the question, how is Christianity supposed to work, and how does it work, in fact, when it actually works? We're all experts on how it's not working very well, but some of us, at least, are called by the church to think about how it's supposed to work. And so I want to do some theoretical reflection on the meaning of God today, and it's no accident that I chose the word meaning to be a part of the title. The word God, first of all, is an abstraction. I know it doesn't sound that way if you're sitting there thinking of very concrete pictures and images, but in fact, the word itself is an abstraction. And therefore, we have to ask the question, what does it mean? One of the exercises that we have students do at Trinity Seminary in Columbus, where I teach, one of the exercises is that they must take all the abstract words in the theological vocabulary and put them into sentences that begin X means blank. So with the word God. They must fill out a sentence, God means blank. What we are doing when we ask a meaning question is to give concretion to an abstraction, to make what is abstract concrete. So I could say, God means blue cheese. I love blue cheese. We're not very far off here. I love it passionately. I'm not exactly going to live or die for blue cheese, but I'd sure go a long ways for blue cheese, especially thick chunks of it in nice cream. I don't mean the stuff that just where they waved a little blue cheese over it and then sort of given an odor. But now you at least know that for me, the word God has this kind of concrete meaning. The next question that we can do, of course, is to ask, on what grounds do you say God means blue cheese? And then we can sort of test out the grounding, and we can say, well, those aren't very adequate grounds at all. Those are not appropriate grounds. And I'm certainly not going to follow you around if you go around proclaiming that God means blue cheese. And then I'll say, all right, what does God mean to you? And you'll probably say, God means a banana peel. And I'll say, that's even less well-grounded. But you see, we aren't able to deal with the question of the reasons why we think something until we have laid out what it is that we are thinking about. So the question, what does the word God mean, leads us to recognize that that we have to then get concrete about our language. So the second thing to be said about the word God is that it is a generic abstraction. It's not a it's not only not concrete in that it is abstract, but it is a generic abstract. That is, it covers lots of instances. The very conversation, imaginary, that we might have had, in which I say God means blue cheese and you insist that God means a banana peel, indicates that the word can cover a vast variety of meanings, and therefore it is a generic word. So now, once we have identified these observations about God, we get to ask the very important question, which God, from among all the possible gods that we could talk about, which God do you mean when you use the word? This seems to be somewhat shocking to us because the word God comes so easily to our lips in American culture, and our political candidates regularly invoke God, and our official prayers and chaplains of our culture regularly use the word God, and everybody proceeds as if we didn't ever have to ask the question, what does the word mean and which God are you talking about? But I think for people in ancient Israel, this was a very vital question. They were a small group of people who functioned in the larger Middle Eastern world, and they had all kinds of gods floating around. In Canaan, for example, there were the Baals, the local deities, the gods of fertility and of growth, the gods of storm, and so on. But one of the interesting things is that the Elijah story, remember, where he raises the widow's son in Phoenicia and sees to it that her flour bin never goes empty and her oil cruse always has oil in it. The astonishing thing about that story is Israel's God is not tied to a local territory. Israel's God can do things outside of Israel. There are a whole set of stories associated with Elijah and Elisha that illustrate the point that Israel thought its God was bigger than the Baals of Canaan. So the question, which God, was very much alive for the people of Israel. It was also very much alive for the earliest disciples of Jesus, because they lived in a culture where every city had its local deities and where there was a huge pantheon of gods and goddesses in the ancient Roman and Greek worlds. So it's similarly, right now in the USA, with huge numbers of religions competing for our attention, it's very important for us once again to ask the question, which God are we talking about? What do we mean by the word God? And then which of all the gods are we really talking about when we talk about the God of Christianity? When we further ask the question, how adequately or appropriately grounded is your answer to the question God means, and to the question which God are you talking about, then we come into the business of evaluating gods. This is probably the hardest thing for Americans to do. We have learned very sadly through the bitterness which religious rivalry and religious hostility, the bitter things that we can do to each other. Bosnia would be an example of how Catholic Christians and Orthodox Christians can be murderous toward one another and toward Muslims who are not Christians at all. In India, we see these kinds of stories. Northern Ireland, Catholics and Protestants at each other's throats. So in a sense, in America, what we have learned to do is sort of like Coco-san in the Mikado. You are right and I am right and we are both as right can be, and let's not be too hasty to judge one another's gods. But in point of fact, Christians do believe that Jesus alone has something to do with God, and that anything that does not relate to Jesus is outside of the reality of God. And so it's important for us, I think, at least to take a look at how we evaluate the various gods. I think there are good ways as well as bad ways of doing this evaluation. And I want to say some things about that tomorrow when we talk about the history of Jesus and the meaning of the reign or ruling or reigning of God. When the word God is used as a generic abstraction, it's important for us again to note that it has an interesting history, that the word itself has an interesting history. When we use the word God with a small g, we are really talking about whatever is the focus of one's life. The word God with a small g, whatever is the focus or the goal or the determinant of my existence. So Luther can say in the first commandment, the explanation of the first commandment, what does it mean to have a God, he asks. And then he answers, a God is whatever we hang our heart on, whatever we look to for all good, and whatever we flee to for refuge in all time of need. In other words, when I'm really up against it, what is it that I pray to? When airplane rides start getting bumpy for me, that's that's when I begin to discover what my God is, because I hate bumpy flights and absolutely refuse to believe all the aeronautic theory that says this plane can withstand five times any bumps that you're going through. I see those wings flapping out there and I say, oh God, and then I'm reminded of what Luther is talking about. Okay, so with a small g, God means whatever is the focus of one's existence, whatever we hang our heart on, whatever we look to for all good. With a large G, we get into something even more interesting. I just, courtesy of Frank here, read Gail Ramshaw last night, God Beyond Gender. And she has some very interesting things to say about the term God with a capital G. She says, with a capital G, God is a male term. In one sense, we have not accomplished anything if we substitute God for the word Father in the first for the first person of the Trinity, because the consort of the word God, capital G, is goddess. And so she says that we are talking about God as Zeus or Jupiter when we just use capital God, capital G. Zeus or Jupiter, Zeus, the Greek head god, had a consort, Hera, who was a sort of mean scold, and he was literally with Hera, the father of the rest of the gods in the pantheon, who were then identified with various forces of nature, the sea or the storms or war or grain and harvest and so on. It's only over a period of development that the word God came to be used without a consort, a goddess, but it still carries strong male or masculine overtones, even used just by itself. The Greeks thought of this god not only as father of the gods together with the goddess Hera, but also as the literal father of humanity. In fact, Zeus could change himself into a human being and sire with human mothers, all kinds of heroes and leaders mythology and sagas that the Greeks told of themselves. So it's important for us, I think, to get at the question, what do we mean when we use the word God? I've entitled this whole series The Trinity and the Table because I think it would be much better for us as Christians, certainly much more accurate, if instead of simply using the word God, we always used it with the adjective triune. Then we have identified ourselves in the sense that we're not talking about some God out of polytheism, out of the Greek or Roman past, or out of pasts that go even farther back than the Greeks and the Romans. So for us to say triune God would be more helpful than just simply to use the word God, because then we have said which God it is we're talking about. The question still remains, does even the notion of Trinity have any concrete meaning? And therefore, I want to begin this morning by having us start looking at the narratives of Jesus, because it is in the narratives of Jesus that Christians receive concrete meaning, or derive concrete meaning for the language that they want to use about the triune God. And I'm going to start with the text of Mark 16, verses 1 to 8. Before we look at that, however, let me stop and just say, does anybody, are you with me so far? Do you understand what I'm trying to say when I say God is an abstraction, God is a generic term? How do we get concrete, and how do we ask which of the concretions do we want to talk about? Are you with me on that so far? Or do you want to argue with that? Or do you want to challenge it or add to it or do anything with it? Anybody? We'll move on. I should add that Nancy Vignek had a very good clarifying question about all of that. She said she does not think of God, she said, in concrete terms. So then I said, well, how do you think about God? And she said, well, as an idea or an experience. And I said, ideas are definitely concrete. And then we talked about the power, for example, that an idea can have. Abraham Lincoln, in the Gettysburg Address, advanced a notion. He said America was dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. He meant all human beings, but he said all men are created equal. But that was a new, in a sense, a new definition of America. It's had a very powerful history because Martin Luther King Jr. then picks this up in his I Have a Dream speech, and we all just sort of take it for granted today that America is built on this powerful idea of Lincoln's. Adolf Hitler had a powerful idea too. The Germans are the master race, and they deserve to have the Slavs literally as their slaves, and they deserve to exterminate Jews. That was a powerful idea, and it captured Germany, or at least enough Germans to give Hitler power, and left the worst scar imaginable on our century. So ideas are very definitely concretions. To say God means an idea is to say something quite concrete and quite powerful. Similarly, to say God means an experience, if you can put down what experience, again you have a concretion. Well, let's look now.
I do have two short questions. Sorry.
Go ahead. No, don't apologize.
Your thesis here about God is a generic term and the difference between a small g and a large g, a common noun and a proper noun, how would that relate to Luther's great image of the face versus the
backside
of God? But would the backside of God be, in this thesis, a small g, and the face of God, that is the mercy and grace, be the large g? Or is there no relationship between those two?
No, I think, let me start with the face, because I think that's easiest. I think what Luther means when he talks about the face of God is being able to identify God. When Luther talks about the backside of God, God a posteriori, what he really means is consequences that awe us, or that scare us. When one looks at the devastation of a hurricane, one is in a sense seeing what Luther would term the sort of backside of God. But he is using God here in the sense of an elemental force. I almost think a small g, an elemental force that overwhelms us and before which we feel utterly, utterly helpless. In the story out of which this develops, Elijah in the cave, it's the fierce wind and the flame. I suppose one would think of the firebombing of Hamburg, where the flames were so intense that people couldn't run from them, they were just sucked up into them. That's so awesome a power that one can cannot, in fact, deal with it. And that would be really the backside. So face is identity. Yes.
Well, even though we have we all have ideas about God, and even though ideas are concrete, because God is abstract, it seems to me that we have a hard time finding the language to define that idea. And I'm not sure that's possible when God is abstract, even though we have an idea about who God is. I'm not sure we're ever going to be able to really come to any kind of a conclusion or get around any kind of a definition of our idea because we don't have the language for it. Because God, by definition, is abstract. And I don't see how we can I don't see how ideas can ever become concrete.
You mean ideas of God or ideas, period?
Ideas of God.
That's an important observation.
And I think that's one of the frustrations we're having with the language discussion. We simply can't put into language what our ideas are because God's too abstract, it seems to me.
Well, I'm trying to get at that. In short, the point of the studies all week long are that I think Christians don't think God is simply an idea. I think Christians think God has a face in the sense in which Luther talks about it. And that's what I want to get at by starting with narrative, with stories. Because one of the things that helps to identify God, take it out of the realm of abstraction and the generic, is to tell stories. So the Babylonians would say Marduk is God. All right, what did they mean by Marduk? They would tell a story. Marduk is the sky god who, in conflict with the sea god Tiamat, who is also his mother, slices the sea god in half and uses the top half of Tiamat for the sky, the saucer over us, and the bottom half of Tiamat for the earth. And now, I mean, we may think this is a kind of silly story, but you see what it does. It nevertheless renders concrete what the Babylonians thought God was, gave a kind of face to Marduk. And then they went on to say, and Marduk created all the orders from the king, who is Marduk's son, down through the nobility into the slaves. So Marduk gives order to all of Babylon, and that's part of the story as well. Now, the question that has to be asked then is, how adequately grounded is the story of Marduk? Are there good reasons why we all ought to abandon Jesus and go to Marduk? I think there are lots of reasons not to, and I'm better at those than why we ought to. But I'd love to meet a Babylonian someday who will give me the positive reasons for Marduk. I was only trying to say to Nancy, an idea is also a concretion. But there may be as many ideas of God as there are people in the world, and we still have to ask each one, how adequate is your idea? How well grounded, how well reasoned and argued? Yes?
A different dimension to that, I think I'm kind of where Nancy is. An idea really isn't concrete until it results in a response or an action, which is precisely why the story is the playing out of how we understood the idea and why the idea takes on multiple different dimensions and you can test it. But I don't understand how an idea can be concrete because the idea isn't concrete, it's the response or action which is the concrete.
If you can think it at all, it's concrete.
Only if I respond in some way to that.
It has a further dimension of concreteness in your response. But if you couldn't think it at all, then of course there would be nothing there. The moment you can think it, it's something. Even if you haven't put it into action.
I'll play that out with you.
Well, I think the main point I would like to make here, at least, is however you fill in the blank, you have a concretion. And of course, there are all kinds of levels of concretion. Not very few of my thoughts get acted on. Thank goodness. I like to play with ideas. I like brainstorming a lot. But in brainstorming, if 10% of the ideas are worth acting on and 1% ever get done, you're really lucky. So one, but the moment you have a thought, it's something, right? That's, in fact, that's what brainstorming is about. It's trying to evoke as many somethings as possible. And then from among them, you say, ah, this is a good one. Does any sense at all?
Some, yes.
All right.
It depends very much on what your definition of concrete is.
Good. Yes, yes, exactly. And I'm trying to say concretion is, in a sense, anything that we can put in the blank, at least with reference to God. And there are truly various levels. Hitler had the idea, Germany is the master race. It was, of course, a lot of other stuff that made it possible for him to put it into practice, but he had the idea, and the idea was already something. Well, yes?
Maybe the idea is only part of something, though. I mean, Hitler may have had his doubts. He may have had the idea that Germans were not the master race, which might have given more impetus to his vicious behavior in response to the idea that they were, mm-hmm. because he didn't like the ambiguity. And Marduk is probably expressed in more ways than being the saucer over and the saucer under. That's one image of God that those people could give language to. But I'm with Dr. Niedringhaus down here, who says we can't give language adequately to our notion of God. We can use images, and we do, and we can tell stories. But they're all inadequate. I mean, we look as silly as they look. We probably say God is a saucer over and a saucer under too in our worship and not in our prayer.
We're a long way from trying to identify what kind of language Christians have available to them. That was where I was trying to get at. The theoretical part of what I was trying to do this morning, or what I have been trying to do, is simply to say the word God itself doesn't yet tell us what we mean or which of the many meanings available to us is the one that identifies what Christians mean when they speak about God. And I haven't even gotten to the Christian part. Well, I was trying to use Marduk is a good illustration because there are no Marduk worshippers around anymore, and there's no, in a sense, it's an illustration that enables us to see what's going on when one identifies God without necessarily getting us into the issue of Christian identification.
I'm wary of any notion of complete identification because I don't think our language is adequate to the task or our imaginations.
And even the stories that we have, like the Babylonians said, even the stories we have about what our God is like are probably not completely recorded in the Bible. I'm sure they're not. I'm sure there's aspects of God that we have no concept of because they're not recorded in this book. And we have some, and then we derive some of our stories from this book. That's the only thing we have. But there's also other areas that help us have ideas about that aren't related to stories recorded in the Bible, I think.
Yes, I can live with all of that. I mean, I can grant all of that. I'm wary of injecting that before we start. I used to have a professor who always said, you can't dismount from a horse until you've first mounted. So one of the things I would like to do is to push within the framework of the term itself, the word God, I would like to push Christian resources as far as possible to see where we get. And then if we have to get off the horse, I'll be the first one to dismount. But to start by saying we aren't going to get anywhere means we could just sort of close the books and walk away at this point. I'd like us to look at Christian narratives at this point, which may or may not seem silly, but look at them first of all, see how far they take us, see what they can do for us, and then decide whether it's time to get off the horse or even where to get off the horse. Because in the end, I'm probably going to grant, yes, we have come to the limit. Here we got to get off the horse. But let's see how far we can go.
Let's do that.
All right. The resurrection. Mark 16. If you have RSV Bibles, you will probably notice that there is a longer ending for Mark. And in fact, there are several endings proposed, and the longer ending is in italics, at least in some RSVs. I've got them identified in the NRSV quite carefully. Scholars have long pondered this business of the ending of Mark. And some notions as to why Mark ends where it does are sort of silly. One thesis was that Mark was interrupted by the bell at Holden and never got back to finishing the gospel. Another thesis is that the scroll was torn off at just the point where the gospel now ends, because it ends with a preposition. It ends with the word for. Everything that we have up in verse 8 is in Mark's gospel, but it ends strangely. Most scholars today think that Mark's gospel ends the way it does because Mark's whole intention was that the gospel is completed in the discipleship of the community. The gospel is in a sense, the story itself is not the whole story of Christ's being in the world and of the Christian being in the world. And so, because Mark's gospel is about Jesus and his disciples, the ending is still going on. Well, we'll see if that's a possibility after we look at the story itself. One question to be asked is, why begin with the resurrection at all? Why would Christians start there? Why not start at the beginning of the story somewhere and work our way towards the resurrection? I think the reason for it can be found in part, at least, in some words of John Shea in his book Stories of God, where he says we're all middle people. That is, our stories begin for us in the middle of things. My grandson Kenneth is here in Holden right now. He's 17 months old, and he knows a lot of things, mountain and deer and squirrel and so on, but he's not going to remember his being at Holden at age 17 months any more than our son Greg remembers being at Holden at age 2 1/2. We don't begin to remember things until somewhere down the road. We can retrieve our past and complete our story, but we begin it, we start it in the middle of things. We're all of a sudden there. Now, that's one reason for saying, yes, we ought to begin with the resurrection, but the second and more important reason is, I think, we would not pay attention to Jesus at all apart from the story of the resurrection. It is the resurrection that makes the rest of Jesus' past and the expectations and promise of the future important to us. My teachers in Germany and one of my friends here in the United States both wrote about this. Günter Bornkamm, in his book, or in the New Testament, A Guide to Its Writings, has this to say: the Gospels and the Jesus tradition they enshrine are rooted in the certainty of the resurrection of Christ. It may sound like nonsense, but we venture to say that the Gospel story begins with its end, For Jesus' Jewish opponents and for the Roman occupying power, there could be no doubt that his end on the cross was the annulment of his story. Finished, done with, over. For the disciples, on the other hand, the appearances of the risen one and their experience of his presence in the Spirit meant that his end was a new beginning, in the sense of a final and absolute act of God for the salvation of the world. Humans had condemned Jesus, but God turned their no into a yes. In that yes, God was committed to the world that had rejected Jesus. And Robert Smith, in his book, The Easter Gospel, says, "The Gospels are Easter books not only because they end as they do, they are Easter books from beginning to end, penned by people who in various ways, not always in the same way, knew Jesus as raised from the dead, forever alive and mighty." And I think this is the reason why it's necessary for us to start here. If one looks at the earliest proclamation of the gospel, the good news was quite simply, Jesus is risen. They didn't start by saying, Jesus died to save you from your sins. That may be a true statement, but it is secondary. It is down the road from the primary one, which is Jesus has been raised. So here's Mark's way of telling the story. He ends the last couple of verses of 15. He rolled a stone against the door of the tomb. Joseph did. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joses, saw where the body was laid. And now when the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James and Salome, brought spices so that they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. They had been saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance to the tomb?" But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled back. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. But he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has been raised. He is not here. Look, there is the place they laid him. Go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." So they went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. There are many things that are truly strange about this story. One of them, of course, is that the grave is empty. Another is that there is someone there to interpret the emptiness of the grave. But I think the most astonishing thing of all is that the women flee in terror from the grave and say nothing to anyone. We could think of all kinds of reasons why they might say nothing to anyone, afraid they'd be laughed at perhaps, but that isn't the kind of terror that Mark is talking about here. What's interesting or what ought to be interesting to us is this is not happy ending sort of stuff, for one thing. It's more complicated than that. Last night, in the proclamation, the gospel was the raising of this young man from Nain, given back to his mother. News of this spreading rapidly, all around, within minutes, everybody telling everybody, because indeed it was happy ending stuff. It was the kind of thing of which happy endings are made, given back to his mother. She has a place in society again. She has a son back. All kinds of important happy endings happen in that narrative. And one unhappy ending. The young man of Nain died later. We don't know when. Luke doesn't tell us. Nobody tells us. But the death rate remains one per person. In his case, two. Now, what happens? What happens? He is resuscitated. It's the same sort of thing that happens when your heart stops and somebody, by doing CPR or whatever, gets it going again. You are resuscitated. You are given a second opportunity to live. Or on the operating table, they stop all processes while they're doing an open heart surgery and then start it all up again with an electrical shock to the heart. And you are back in business, so to speak. That's what's going on in the resuscitations that the Gospels describe. That's not what happens here. And we need a different word for what happens here to talk about the terror and the astonishment that the women encounter. I've put that word on the board behind me. It's a huge theological term. It's called eschatological. Well, let's try to do something with that word. Eschatological comes from the Greek word eschaton, which means end, but not in the sense of the end of a mystery novel. I like mystery novels, and I like the fact that they tie up all the loose ends. You know who did it, and you can have Hercule Poirot or Miss Marple or Brother Cadfael, who's my favorite right now, they'll tie up all the loose ends. And you feel very good and you go to sleep at night because everything is settled and solved. That's not what eschaton means. Eschaton means an opening out into the future so that we can finally see how it is all going to come out, what the outcome is. It's more like lived happily ever after. It's outcome in that sense of lived happily ever after. Now, the disciples encounter the resurrection of Jesus as an eschatological event, as an event that opens up the future to them in an astonishing way. When I read mysteries, I always read the last chapter first. It's terrible. I know there are people who think it ruins it. If you're going to stop listening at this point, I apologize. But I read the last chapter, and I do so for a couple of reasons. One is that if they're going to bump off any characters along the way, I don't want to get emotionally involved in them. I only have so much emotional energy for reading a novel, and I don't want to waste it on somebody who's not going to be around at the end. But the other reason is that it changes the way I participate in the story. It really does. I now notice the false leads from the true lead, and I notice how the author is crafting the whole novel. It saves me reading it twice by reading the last chapter first. And I participate in it differently. Now, what the disciples encountered is the last chapter, not just the last chapter of their lives, but the last chapter of all of history itself. They saw what the outcome is going to look like. And more importantly, they discovered who is in charge of the outcome. They discovered the identity of the final judge. We say in the creed, you see, at the end of the second article, who will come again to be our judge? Well, the judge is the one who has the last word in the courtroom, right? I mean, you can be disappointed in what the judge says the last word is, but there's no arguing with Lance Ito in Los Angeles. When he says this is the way it's going to be, that is the way it's going to be. So now they discover the identity of the judge. This is really and truly astonishing, but it is also very, very frightening. Robert McAfee Brown, in his book on faith, has a chapter in which he says, he entitles the chapter, "The Fear That Faith Is Not True." And he follows it immediately with another one, "The Fear That Faith Is True." See, this is what Mark is doing. What if, in fact, it is true that Jesus is the final judge? What if everything that Jesus was up to is true? What if all that he promised is true? I mean, that's really scary. If reading the last chapter changes the way you participate in a mystery story, what if you discover that Jesus' way of being in and for the world is God's final truth? I mean, you see, that means our own lives are going to have to change if that's true. I was in Cambridge in April, and as the dean of Clare College and I were walking to Clare College for dinner, we suddenly saw somebody pushing a wheelchair out of a doorway, and he, 20 yards ahead of us or so, and the dean said to me, "That's Stephen Hawking." And it was. There he was, in a wheelchair. Stephen Hawking, greatest theoretical physicist in the world today. Hawking's Brief History of Time says that the last chapter is going to be what he calls the big crunch, when all of time collapses in on itself, and we will all live our lives over one more time backwards. And then we will not have been. Think of that. Now you put a marker on a gravestone today and you say, "That's where my father is buried. He was from 1902 to 1970. But what if, having lived everything backwards, we will never have been? I mean, that is the ultimate in nothing. Right? In nothing. It's a possible outcome. How would you live your life if you believed that the last word was going to be having to live it over again backwards? Or what if death has the last word? Not Hawking's crunch, but just death. How would you live your life? Well, I'd probably take the feel young laxative and use Grecian Formula 16 on my beard and try to stay in the Pepsi generation as long as I could. And I think one person wrote that if Jesus is risen, we all learn that there is more to do with our lives than to preserve them. Well, that's an astonishing conclusion. And it's enough to scare anybody. What if it is true that the cross happens to people who are Jesus' disciples? What if that really is true? So I think what happens in the resurrection is that we discover the identity, or at least those who believe in Jesus discover the identity of the one who is in charge of history's outcome. And that is what Christians mean, I think, by the word God. It is not all that Christians mean by God, but it is at least starting place. It was not very long in the New Testament before hymns began to be sung about Jesus, like the one quoted in Philippians 2. He was in the morphe theou, the form of God, but emptied himself and became obedient, took upon himself a slave's form and became obedient unto death. Wherefore he has been highly exalted and given the name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow and every tongue confess that he is Lord, to the glory of the Father. Well, that's a high estimate of Jesus. Prayers begin to be addressed to him almost from the beginning. And so while Christians do not think that Jesus exhausts what God means, they at least know this is where to start. Jesus is, in some sense, what God means. Now, what I want to do tomorrow, then, is to go back and ask, what if the disciples encounter Jesus and he is really mad? Because, after all, they have all betrayed him and fled from him and let him down. And the Romans executed him shamefully. We want to look at the Gospels as a clue to what kind of judge Jesus will be. And then we want to look on Wednesday at what kind of promises about the future can be made. In the Gospel here, the disciples are told that Jesus is going ahead of them into Galilee. All the scholars believe that Galilee doesn't literally mean the Galilee. Galilee means the world. Jesus goes out ahead of the disciples. One always has to take, I think, into account four things about the resurrection. The first one is the tomb is empty. There is continuity between whoever was put into the tomb and whoever they encountered. The second thing is women are the earliest, and in Mark's gospel, the only witnesses. They weren't credible. When Paul gives his list of witnesses in Romans and 1 Corinthians 15, he doesn't have any women in it. Here the NRSV doesn't help us by translating the male term, brothers, with brothers and sisters, because it misses the point. Paul didn't want any women listed as witnesses, because it would have hurt his case. One of the problems of being an apostle, especially a male apostle, especially Paul, he didn't want any women witnesses. But within a half a generation, Mark's gospel has only women. They aren't more credible, but you can't tell the story without them. It's one of God's great jokes that what made the story less credible, in Paul's thinking at least, makes it more credible to us today, because he uses, Mark has only women as witnesses. Thirdly, Mark doesn't have any appearances, but there are appearances. And finally, there are disappearances. They are as important as the appearances. And they raise the question, where does he go? Answer, he goes to the future and therefore is not gone. Because if he goes out of this world, then we got to really wonder how we get there. But if he goes ahead of us, then he is not gone. He is present and available as the power of the future, so that everything we are empowered to do as Christian people comes from the one who is risen from the dead and available to us as the power of the future. Well, we've got more to do this week. I'm going to go on from here. Jesus is at least what Christians mean by God, but not all that Christians mean by God. Is that enough for one day? Have a good one.